Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Larry Sampler, Assistant to the Administrator and Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID. So, Larry, 2014 marks a significant transition period for Afghanistan and for USAID. To that end, would you describe your threefold transition strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question. This year will mark the first transition from one democratically elected president to another in Afghanistan, and that's huge for the Afghans. It also it marks the end of ISAF's warfighting mission in Afghanistan, which is also huge. But that's a transition that really began almost a year and a half to 2 years ago when ISAF first began closing provincial reconstruction teams, what we call PRTs, around the country, and began reducing the size of their footprint from over 150 or 60,000 troops to now I think U.S. troops to the ground are in the 30,000s. And by the end of the year, will be much smaller. So the transition is something that started months and months ago, and we're moving through. 2014 will be a point of inflection. December the 31st will be a legal point where, you know, orders are changed and the names of particular things change. And then begins what the Afghans call their decade of transformation. USAID's roles are politically and from a societal point of view to communicate to the Afghans a sense of engagement. We're not walking away. Mm-hmm. There is not an American withdrawal from Afghanistan. There is a military withdrawal from Afghanistan. So to that end, the things that we can do to communicate our steadfast engagement are helpful. We focus on kind of three segments of our engagement. One is we want to make sure that the gains made in health, education, and the empowerment of women don't slip. Mm-hmm. Those are the areas where I think we feel are the building blocks of a sustainable Afghan society, and we want to make sure that the heavy investment of money and resources, intellectual and human capital, aren't frittered away or aren't lost. Mm-hmm. So we'll continue to support education, perhaps increasingly adding capacity at the higher education level so that as students move through the primary and secondary schools, they have a place to go. We'll continue to support access to health care. We will probably not continue to expand access to health care because our financial resources won't allow that. Mm-hmm. And right now, there's an issue of Afghan capacity to absorb and sustain it. So we'll be working with the Afghans on how do you sustain the gains that you've made in health care thus far. The second thing is this transition period is going to be economically painful for Afghanistan. As the international militaries have drawn down, their secondary and tertiary contributions to the economy of Afghanistan are also being diminished. And there will continue to be, for some period of time, a budget gap, a budget deficit in Afghanistan that will require donor support. Mm-hmm. So we want to focus on helping the Afghans bridge the dip in GDP. Just for frame of reference, in 2012, GDP was about $20.5 billion. From 2002 to 2012, it grew at about 9 or 10% a year. Again, astronomical growth rates, but considering where they started from, it can be expected. But in 2014, the anticipation is that it will be a 6.5% growth. 2015, it will slow to 5.5%. In 2016, we're expecting it will slow yet again to 4.5%. The government revenues in Afghanistan have grown by 20% a year since 2002. But that's not enough to cover the gap. We again do expect there'll be a budget deficit for years to come that the donors will have to help the government of Afghanistan close. And that's a segue to the third point, which is increasing the credibility and the capacity of the Afghan government. In development circles, there's sort of a debate about which comes first, the grassroots development of government capacity, the ability to fix potholes in the streets and to collect the trash. In Iraq, we call it sewage, water, electricity, and trash. What does the government do for a family living in a certain address? And that's juxtaposed with the requirement to build a national government that can react to regional neighbors and set up regional economic trade.
So with the transition, I want you to identify other USAID's priorities going forward. You've probably touched on the Afghanistan part of your portfolio. But what about Pakistan going forward? What are your priorities?
One of the things I have to keep in mind as I support this particular program and portfolio of Afghanistan and Pakistan is balancing my resources, intellectual and my energy on both countries. Someone once said that 20 years from now, Afghanistan will still be a country. It'll still look much the way it looks now, and it will still be making progress from a very, very technologically primitive society to entering the world of modern technology and capacities. But that Pakistan, they were not so sure, because Pakistan is already, technology is there, 190 million people, I believe, massive population with tremendous challenges facing it in terms of healthcare and education, internal extremist violence. So in Pakistan, we're focusing our portfolio in five areas. First and perhaps foremost is energy. Pakistan has a number of problems with their electrical energy grid. And part of the problem is generation. They have to be able to generate enough electricity to satisfy domestic needs, and right now they can't. They have tremendous capacity, both with respect to natural gas and hydroelectric generation, that just requires capital investment that right now they can't attract. They cannot generate enough revenue to pay for the electricity that they generate, so the government has to step in and pay for it. Mm-hmm. And it's a self-defeating cycle. So they have to, we're focusing on helping them build generation capacity, helping them address technical losses, and helping them address governance and revenue collection aspects with respect to the energy portfolio. We also have economic growth in agriculture. Pakistan also is a tremendously agrarian society. There are issues with respect to food security, issues with respect to malnutrition in Pakistan. So economic growth, particularly with respect to agriculture, is an area where we're focusing as well. In Pakistan, we're also focusing on stabilization. Your listeners may be familiar with some of the areas of Pakistan that are not nearly as developed as others, specifically Balochistan, what they call the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, areas in the federally administered tribal areas have not had the kind of development the rest of Pakistan has enjoyed. So in those areas, we have programs that are aimed at stabilization, at showing the local population the value of engaging with their central government and making them feel, in fact, like it is their central government. So it goes back to those basics of sewage, water, electricity, and trash, education, health care. What sorts of goods and services does the government of Pakistan owe to those particular citizens? And then does that generate, how do we help that generate a quid pro quo of buy-in to the government, which presumably would mean less headway and less opportunity for malevolent and violent extremist groups that form in those areas. So energy, economic governance, particularly agriculture, stabilization, and then the last two areas are, again, health and education. You know, health has an impact on everything. If young men and women are not getting the right nourishment during their formative years, it produces stunting, which is both physical and mental and emotional. And it is in everyone's best interest to see that the next generation of Afghans have the physical and intellectual capacity to seize the economic opportunities that we're hoping will be provided for them. It's in no one's best interest for these young men and women to not have the critical thinking skills necessary to resist violent extremists when they come recruiting. So that's a specific way that investments in health and then in education, which teaches these critical thinking skills and teaches the skills needed to enter the legitimate licit economy, you know, those do contribute to national security. It's in an indirect way in some respects, but it doesn't require imagination. It just requires foresight mm-hmm. to see that we want the next generation of young Afghan and young Pakistan men in particular to have the intellectual capacity and then the critical thinking skills to say no to violent extremists. And that requires them to have economic and licit opportunities that they can say yes to, because they have to make a living. They have to make enough money to get married. They have to be able to take care of their families. And if they can't do it in ways that are licit and constructive and supportive of the government, they will unfortunately turn to other means.
So I'd like to go back to the transition. And I'm really interested in how USAID has possibly operationally adjusted its implementation model to improve sustainability and meet those challenges you outlined presented by the transition. How have you guys done that?
Beginning in 2006 and 2007, when parts of Afghanistan were for the first time being denied to us for reasons of security, USAID faced sort of an existential question. Do we just abandon programming in areas that are denied to us and write the investments off and then abandon that population for the time being? Or do we find ways to sustain those programs in hopes that they will help to win the population over to the national government of Afghanistan and sort of dilute or diffuse the non-permissive environment? Clearly, it's in our best interest to find ways to sustain that programming. And so we came up with what we called monitoring and evaluation programs or remote monitoring programs. And this was just a way to assess the progress that programs are making without U.S. government employees physically going out and kicking the tires, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In many respects, we've done this around the world, and we've done this for decades. You would not send a U.S. government employee necessarily, like me, out to evaluate a new bridge. Mm-hmm. We would hire a civil engineer and a structural engineer, and we would send them out to look at the bridge. But there was always the prospect that, you know, Mr. Sampler could come walk and stomp on the bridge if he wanted to and inspect the progress. So if we remove that direct hire's ability to visit some of these programs, we want to make sure that our contracts or our agreement officer, and that's really the person responsible for signing on a daily basis, this program goes forward or this program stops, that contract officer has to have good quality information from a variety of sources with a regularity and a robustness mm-hmm. that convinces her or him that this program is making progress and it is a good use of tax dollars. So with that as our benchmark, how we get that level of information to the contract officer began with a couple of programs in 2007 and 8. We have one called the Implementation Management Unit that focused aggressively on hiring Afghans with the right skill sets. Again, that the bridge example, Afghan civil engineers or maybe a Pakistani civil engineer would be hired as a contractor to go out and inspect the bridge. And he or she would be given a cell phone or a camera that takes kind of, you know, geocoded photographs, so we get a date time stamp and a location stamp. And the engineer comes back and says, I crawled all over this bridge. It's a good, solid bridge, and here's the photographs to back it up. That's probably enough to supply a contract officer with the information that she needs to say, yes, we'll pay this contractor. It's harder to do on democracy and government programs. Mm-hmm. That's where the cell phone technology that I talked about earlier comes into play. We have the ability to do crowdsourcing, yes. where if there's a school built in a particular community, we can SMS messages to the or phone calls to the community and say, are the teachers at school? And if so, how many teachers are at school? So we have ways that to collect information that lets us make decisions during this transition period that are still just as sound and just as responsible as they were in the early years. We've just replaced, in most cases, U.S. government direct hire boots on the ground with a multiplicity of other capacities.
What are USAID's priorities going forward for Afghanistan and Pakistan? I will ask Larry Sampler, Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.